Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome to Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history. And I'm your host for Cup of Joe, Karen Peter. Our guest today is Richard James. Now, Richard is the son of a Welsh coal miner and was born in, now I'm going to take a huge try here, Richard. I didn't ask you, so we'll see how I do well. Penlagair?
Not too bad. Penlagair.
Okay. Say it again, please.
Penlagair.
Okay. All right. I didn't mangle it too bad. Thank you. Swansea. At least that's how I'd pronounce Swansea in the United States, South Wales, in the United Kingdom. He is an associate of the Chartered Institute of Bankers in the United Kingdom and has a Master of Arts in Religion from the Community of Christ Seminary. Richard is also secretary of the Council of 12 Apostles, which is the lead missionary quorum of Community of Christ. And he is assigned to the Eurasia mission field, which includes the British Isles Mission Center, Western Europe Mission Center, and the Eurasia Mission Center, a large area. So, hi, Richard, and welcome to Project Zion.
Well, thank you, Karen, and diolch yn fawr I chi. Thank you. Croeso.
Okay. Are we going to get more Welsh as we go along, Richard?
One or two words thrown in.
Okay. Maybe. All right. So, Richard, we're talking today because you contributed a lecture to the Fall Historic Sites Foundation Church History Series, which is titled Without Boundaries. And your lecture is titled Community of Christ History in Wales, From the Hell of the Coal Face and Iron and Tin Plate Works to Zion. And that captured my attention as I ran through the list of lectures. So to begin with, before we kind of start, based on what you've said already, our listeners probably picked up that you are Welsh, you live in Wales. And so you are most qualified to tell us a little bit about this part of church history. But first, if you would, tell us a little bit about Wales.
Well, I think the first thing to say, yes, I am Welsh and I come from Wales. So just to put a little bit of geography onto this, Wales is a part of the United Kingdom. Many people identify this part of Europe has been England, but in fact, there are four different countries make up the United Kingdom. And another term that we tend to use is Great Britain. So again, Great Britain is three countries. It is Scotland, England, and Wales. And so we're a very proud nation. We have our own language, one or two words that I can speak. It's a Celtic nation. I'm very proud of our Celtic Christianity and connectedness with all of creation. So I would say it's God's country. Some beautiful countryside and ocean, but more importantly, beautiful people.
Of course, we would expect no less knowing you, Richard. And thank you for the clarification about United Kingdom and Great Britain, especially for folks in the United States who don't have a working knowledge of the countries in the United Kingdom. That's very helpful. At least it's very helpful for me to kind of make that distinction. So I promise never to use England when I'm talking about Scotland, Ireland, Northern Ireland, or Wales. So what made you decide, Richard, to do this lecture, to offer a historic sites lecture on the history of the church in Wales? Have you done some of this before? Was this a new idea? What happened?
Yeah, I think when I look at this, it always starts with invitation. Somebody sows a seed of, oh, how about doing something like this? If I look back a little bit, when I was doing my Community of Christ Seminary, Derek Judd, who was an employee of Bishop of the Church, and I did a history of the church in Wales. It's part of our church history model. So that was some initial work we did a little way back. But I think more recently, our online congregation community circle had a Disciples Toolbox in April this year. And the title was History Happens Here, Stories of Community Christ Across Europe. We had multiple storytellers, and Barbara Walden was facilitating the conversation. As the apostle, I was asked just to do an introduction and just draw in a little bit of things together. And naturally, I looked at the history of Wales and just shared a little bit. And then I think Bob thought, maybe we could get Richard to tell us something about the history of the church in Wales. And surprisingly later, I had an invite from Bob to do one of these lectures. It's interesting. I think the thing that really struck me is the rocks in Wales, and they have a story to tell. And maybe I can tell a little bit more about that later. What is in the rocks that make the restoration message come alive?
Okay, I look forward to hearing that story about the rocks in Wales. I'm assuming, since we alluded to the title of your lecture, that it has something to do with the conditions of the people in Wales, how people were living, what was happening historically at that period of time when the church message first came, etc. But I know your lecture, we had the ability to go deeper and a little bit longer. We're going to have to be a little more concise here, but I'd really like to hear more about that, on why, what was happening in Wales, and why were the people why was the situation conducive to the message of the restoration? So if you could just kind of share with us that, and I'll raise my finger and ask questions if something comes up, and let's see where we go with that. So share with us a bit.
Okay, I'll try and paint a picture. And I think it really is important to understand context, context, context. Because when you understand the context, you go, I get it. I see how there was such a huge response of people to this restoration message. So I come back to what I just said earlier. What is in the rocks? What is in this, the rocks around sort of particularly South Wales, that created hell on earth, but created the opportunity for people to respond? So I think you have to look at what was happening contextually. We have the Industrial Revolution making a huge turning point in history in almost all aspects of life. The Industrial Revolution, 1760, 1820, 1840, went from hand production to sort of mass production. And iron was a key part of that production. So what we see in Wales, and very similar to other places in England, a movement of people from being rural farmers to moving into the towns for work. And in the Welsh context, particularly in the South Wales valleys, we see iron ore and a need support the Industrial Revolution to the production of iron. The raw materials were readily available. The rocks, there's coal deep within this place. There's wood, there's limestone. So all the resources are together. What was missing was money. So where does the money come from? The money comes from the slave traders. They were stepping out of slavery because it was recognized not a good business to be in. And where did they put the money? They put the money into the iron in Wales and made more money. I think that's really interesting link, really, between slavery of people in one place and then finding another place to invest their capital, and it created slavery in many ways for people.
So for our American listeners, in mining areas in the United States, we have the same situation in the North. We don't talk about it as much, the connection between slavery, abolition, and mining, but we, the same kind of situation. So, okay.
Yeah, it is. And it's really sort of deep. So you had these sort of merchant traders that set up these ironworks. And so some people, they would quote and say, the people have been deprived of their birthright. It was the resources of the nation of Wales, and they were being extorted by wealthy people for their own gain. And work was really, really hard in these places. Another sort of novel written around the time by Alexander Cordell said it was the rape of the fair country. I know those are very provocative words, but when you sort of see what is done to the environment to extract the work of the iron, but also the impact it had on people's lives. So there's great oppression of people. The natural resources are being abused in some ways to further the richness of these people. So due to the oppression of people, we see a rise in the need for social reform. So politically across the UK, we are seeing movements like the Charterists and other political reformers looking for changes to the political landscape. So that's going on in Wales, and particularly South Wales. So you've got oppression and you've got a movement looking for social reform. In some ways, what's more unique to the Welsh setting is Welsh non-conformist religious tradition. Let me see what that says. I'm a Welshman. I like to say, don't put words into my mouth. I can speak for myself. We tend to speak up if there's any oppression, or if we disagree, then we will say our voice. So you have this tradition of Christianity, which would be the institutional church, Church in Wales, Church in England. And Welsh people were resisting that because that was the religion of their masters, their iron masters, their coal masters. And so what happens is that there is this Welsh non-conformity around Baptists, and not Southern Baptists, this is sort of Baptists and Anabaptists. And they start developing opportunity for expressions of Christianity that are low hierarchy. And if you fall out with your leaders, you just start another church, just non-conform, just one. And so what they were doing, they were offering social reform, but it was reform, but there's a life to come. Let's get you saved now for the life to come. So I see a place like Merthyr Tydfil. Merthyr Tydfil was a really small town, a low population before the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, and dramatically increases. This is where the raw resources are. So there's iron smelting going on in four major works. Ironically, one of these now is a UNESCO heritage site, same status as Taj Mahal. Merthyr's population suffered crime, disease, and squalor, and no sewerage system, so people were walking through sewerage on the streets. You had a mass immigration of people because they're looking for work. These were farmers, not used to urban living. And you also had people returning from the Neapolitan wars that were going on. And so there's this social unrest. Immigrants coming into a place not big enough to cater for people. There's busyness, there's work, there's grime, there's economic boom was happening. There was a slump. The pubs were centres of community. Drinking was a major problem. Maybe from a US context, it was the frontier. It was the wildest place to be. Thomas Carlyle, who's an historian and a writer, says about Merthyr, it was a vision of hell. Yet in the centre of this was radical non-conformity that practiced democratic decision making in the chapels, and the vast majority of people could vote. We take for granted that most people can vote now. This wasn't happening in the UK at that time. Women had no vote. So in the churches themselves, these non-conformists, they were practicing this equality of everybody and everybody having a vote. So also we get great political agitation and unrest and riots going on. And we have this center of charterism happening, a working class movement trying to promote change.
Can you say a little bit more about that? This explain charterism.
Yeah, charterism, it was a national, meaning across Britain, across Great Britain at the time. It emerged in 1836, really active 1838, 1848, with the aim to gain political rights and influences for the working class. So what we were seeing is that the governance was being done by the gentry and by the lords, really unaccountable. And this huge national movement was pushing back against the kind of the UK government. The name charterism came from the People's Charter that they developed 16s. When you look at sort of English political history, it's a really important movement. It was put down by the government. There was a riots in London. But this was going on in South Wales. And so what you've got is a cauldron, really, of religious expression of equality, willingness to dissent, salvation in the future life, and you also got an environment going on of dissenters and wanting political reform. So that's the cauldron that was happening. And then into this comes this restoration message. And which way does it go? I think it's really interesting what happens. So first of all, the message of the restoration comes into North Wales. Early missionaries come into Liverpool, and they go to North, to Preston, to Lancashire, and then they tiptoe into God's country, into Wales, into North Wales, and they have a little success in a place called Overton. So 1837, first missionaries come. 1840, they come into God's country. They have some little success. Here, it's mainly farmers, but there are some coal mines happening. 1843, 3 years later, they step down into this cauldron of activity in South Wales. So in Pendarren, we see our first baptisms in South Wales. Growth is really slow. But 2 years later, something dramatically happens. It happens because there's a Welsh speaker, somebody called Dan Jones. He's originally now in America. He comes back. He's charismatic. He speaks Welsh, and he takes leadership of the church in Merthyr and all of Wales. So from 1845 to 1851, a six-year period, we see a rapid growth from single-digit membership to over 5,000.
That's very huge, typical.
Huge growth.
Yeah.
And it's really sort of typical, really, of sort of Welshness, I think. It was done in three ways. It was done by word of mouth. You had Welsh-speaking missionaries. So we've got to understand, this time in the life of Wales, the Welsh was the dominant language. Now, following suppression by the English government in the 1800s, Welsh language suppressed. But here, the main language spoken was Welsh. So Dan Jones had Welsh-speaking missionaries speak their own language, understand the context, knew exactly what's happening in this cauldron, and started to address it. They had their own publications and pamphlets. The Book of Mormon was translated into Welsh. And two periodicals, Prophets of Jubilee, and Ungone Zion, Zion's Trumpet. They're promoting the Welsh message. And I think what is really interesting here, and I think it's a lesson to learn, the context of a restoration message about equality for everybody, lower hierarchy, people have access to priesthood, people have a right to vote, and this four-letter word called Zion, or five-letter word in Welsh, is saying the social reforms you're looking for, they can happen in this life. You can do something about it. you haven't got to wait till the next life. What the other religious expressions are doing is saying, now you can make a difference. Let's shape this. And so it really, really resonated deep with the context. So as I started off saying, it's context, context, context. Mm-hmm.
And I think connected salvation to social reform, to all of the aspects of the political agony, and it connected to everything that was happening to their lives.
Yeah, it did. You know, so we see a Merthyr Tydfil as a strong center of the Latter-day Saint movement. In 1851, there were almost 2,500 members, 26 branches, just in one county. It's huge. We have our own press there, printing press. You know, I think I shared with you before, Karen, when you look at the migration later of people from Wales and from England to places like Kirtland and Nauvoo, what accent did those people have? They had English or Welsh-speaking accents. Yes, there were some from Denmark and Sweden and Germany, but the dominant voice was an English or a Welsh voice being spoken. There was a huge, huge growth. And a lot of it, for me, goes down to a Welsh-speaking person understanding context, speaks the language, and connects the dots of what is happening in people's lives and saying, look, here is a message for you. So it's in the rocks. The rocks created a wonderful place for God's country. It was abused. And out of the cauldron of people saying, this isn't going to continue anymore, comes a restoration message.
It also, as you're sharing about this, Richard, I know I was going to ask you later in our interview, but you used the word several times, the dissent, the resistance, the nonconformity, the dissent. For our former LDS members, that doesn't resonate as much as it does with someone maybe who grew up in the reorganization, because that's inherent in our institutional culture, is the dissent. And I have a feeling we can trace that somehow to our Welsh ancestry in the church.
I think it's part Welsh. I think in Britain we have this something called loyal opposition, mm-hmm. where it's okay to stand up to the crown at that time and speak. I think in my Welshness and maybe my sort of biased lens, I would say because as a nation we've been oppressed for 800 years by English rule, we have a voice and we're prepared to raise that voice. Mm-hmm. And so we will speak up. And as I said before, don't put words in my mouth, I will speak.
Yeah.
And so it is okay to speak out. And you still, I think also part of Welsh culture is this strong sense of identity of longing and belonging. So I would say, I know I'm Welsh. You can't take that away from me. You know, that is who I am. So I can raise my voice and say, this isn't right. Or can we try this? Can we do this? That's kind of deep within our sort of psyche almost. So the idea of dissent is strong within sort of Welsh culture. And it created this cauldron, is one of the ingredients mm-hmm. that made it such a remarkable sort of growth of the church.
Absolutely. And affected the growth of all the restoration traditions that we have expressed.
Absolutely.
That we participate in the United States and around the world.
Yeah.
So you talked about Dan Jones and his importance as a kind of charismatic leader who understood language and context and the importance of that. Can you tell us about some of the other original members or leaders or figures, if you will, in the church in Wales?
Yeah, I think the research that I've done hasn't gone deep enough yet to draw out some of the stronger characters. I do want to draw on one because it has an impact on Community of Christ history. Well, there are two, but let me stick on one. Somebody called Adelphus Edwards. Okay. Adelphus Edwards, his family are from West Wales. It is called Llanelli. We have a group there. Again, we're talking of a period when the South Wales Coalfield, there are so many congregations, and this is one of the western points. So he's in Llanelli, and then for some reason he goes to Cardiff. Cardiff's the city that I live in. Now it's an hour's drive by car, so maybe on horse and cart it might have been a few days. But he finds himself in Cardiff, and there he's supporting the congregation. And this is what I love, something that's in our church history. It says, he closed the door of the church in Cardiff and moved to USA. That's all it says. Okay. So he closed the door in Cardiff and moved to the USA. And about maybe 15 years ago, I was in Dundalk in Baltimore. And I was sharing this part of the conversation about the connectedness between Wales and the USA. And they said, Delphus Edwards' family came here, and here's some of his family. So he closed the church in Cardiff and started the church in Dundalk in Baltimore. And I think that's incredible how that sort of wherever his journey went, he stayed connected with the church. And then as today, we have been blessed by the Edwards family, as the Paul Edwards connection. Some people might know previous general counselor, Karen Minton is an Edwards. And so there's a number of people that claim that Edwards lineage, as it were. So I don't know a lot of what he did, apart from wherever he went, he formed a church and then kind of moved on.
That's marvelous. And it's delightful that you were there and all of a sudden, oh, yes, he was here.
Yes. Yeah, very much so.
So one of the things you talked about in the church in Wales was this idea of equality and everybody having voice. So I'm interested, did women participate in leadership in the church, or was there still the social inequality of gender?
I would say at this stage, my research doesn't identify that. What we do see is sort of priesthood, which is male at that time, right, in the reorganized church of Jesus Christ of the Saints, rather than Community of Christ. So I would anticipate in a Welsh setting that the women have their say.
They have From what influence. You've said, I would think so.
They have the influence over the men. So I wouldn't have thought there'd be direct leadership. And this is a slight digression here. There's something in Welsh history called the Rebecca Riots. The Rebecca Riot is a huge protest against the turnpike fees that have been charged. And it's called the Rebecca Riots because the men dressed up as women as part of Rebecca rebelling. And it's got this, so this idea of women sort of protesting and saying this isn't enough is a part of the culture, even though the men were dressing up as women, which is it's from a historical point of view, the Rebecca Riots are an important part of our history.
Well, again, I love the fact that masquerading as women thought they would be made them more effective as rebels.
Right.
So kudos to that whole aspect of it. So you live in Wales now. What's the church like now in Wales?
Right. Let me go back a little bit and I'll tell you where we are now, because I think from a history point of view, this is fascinating. It is for me anyway. So first part of the conversation, I was talking about the church prior to the departure of Joseph Smith Jr. 1863, reorganized, our Community of Christ people come. They find a little disarray. The church is decimated at that time, one because of the death of Joseph, but really because of polygamy and Adam God theory. Those did not sit well with Welsh people, not one bit. And also some of the social reform messages that were trying to be enacted through the Restoration Movement already been done. It was starting to rise in socialism, of unions, and later development of a major political party, the Labour Party. So what we see in church records is about sort of 1895, there's about 5,000 members still. And by 1929, there are just two families. you know, and you have to ask yourself, what happened? So, and there are three reasons. So one is that there was a migration to the US. This is in part to do with the Depression era. And as bad as it was in the US, and it was bad, people were still migrating. We also see a time when the church had to lay people off, and they laid off two really significant missionaries and the family connections. So people were upset at that. But the biggest thing that upset people was Fred M. Smith's supreme direction and control, as we call it. This is a time in the history of the church where the president of the church really took control of the leadership and kind of pulled the Council of 12 to order, put the presiding bishopric in a place of. And that supreme direction and control did not sit well with Welsh people. A lot of people left the church. So we find ourselves with just two families. And those two families are back in this town where Adolphus Edwards came from, is in Llanelli. And so Llanelli is our oldest continuing congregation that we have. So right now we have two congregations and a small house group. We closed the congregation about 2 years ago. Well, there was some growth in the early 60s and 70s, as most of Western world saw. But now it's a much smaller expression. Mm-hmm. I do think there's a sense of people understanding who we are and identify with our identity, message, mission, and beliefs. But it's a much, much smaller presence than we have.
So when you talked about supreme directional control from the reorganization's history, after you're setting the context about the Welsh people, it makes sense that that would not have sat well with that. On the flip side of that, in the United States, we understand that the whole notion of membership is changing, what it means to align oneself with an organization or institution. Do you see that in Wales, that people are likely to participate but not align through membership?
I think that's a growing trend, if I say right across my field. Very much so a situation of secularization, people seeing themselves as spiritual but not religious, and looking for expressions of spirituality in many forms. So we have this core of members that are very faithful and very committed. And yes, people would participate. If I look back in sort of my living memory, whilst there was a strong identity being part of the Community of Christ, we would definitely have an ecumenical interaction with other people. And we'd be involved in sort of ecumenical activities. And so people would go to other churches at that time, not from a point of view that one was better than the other, but that was a place where community happened.
Right.
I think the growing trend is about membership, and again resonates well with the Welshness of where do I belong? Where do I show up? Where do I get fed? Or where does this part of me feed? And I think sort of looking forward is identifying what are the cultural things that are happening and what's the resonance of the gospel message.
So as you look forward, what do you see as the future of the church in Wales? How do you envision that?
Let me say, I'm very hopeful for Community of Christ. I think all the wrestles and struggles that we have been going through has enabled us to deal with the next part of our journey. If I look back sort of in Welsh tradition, there is a prophecy given, and at a time of prophecy would have been part of, and this is from a woman who said that once, this was in Llanelli in this small sort of group, mm-hmm. that once again the hills and valleys of Wales will resonate with the sounds of the gospel. So a lot of people are aware of this older sort of prophecy. Now, whether mm-hmm. it's a prophecy or whether it's just wisdom, mm-hmm. I can see hope for Community of Christ in Wales. We have a strong sense of community and dissent and protest. And as we align ourselves with what is happening in our society around us. We have a strong sense of movement in the Europe field about justice and peace and non-violence. And if I look back as what resonated well in the South Wales Valleys was a condition and oppression of people. And so if we can find our voice and we can stand with those that are marginalized or oppressed, then I think there is a hope in the future for us. It's about equality for all. It is a place at the table for everybody. And Wales has got this wonderful sense of hospitality. It's rich within us. You know, a lot of cultures have hospitality as part of traditions. God's Country hasn't missed out on that one. There's always a welcome. You know, I look at my own upbringing in a home where our door was always open, whatever time of the day it was. And it wasn't to see my father, who happened to be the pastor. It was to speak to my mother. Yeah, because she had this ability just to be present with people and just to accept people. And they would share their story or what happened in that day. And sometimes the door would be open at 2 o'clock in the morning and a stranger might walk in. And so that idea of hospitality, invitation, I think fits us well. It fits like a glove into our culture. Yeah. And the sense of community and longing and belonging. And I think that the kind of message, as we say, we follow in Jesus, the peaceful one, in our context, what does that mean? And so I'm very hopeful for Community of Christ.
So we have this mission initiative in Community of Christ, Abolish Poverty and Suffering, which seems to resonate with the history of the church, the story of the history of the church in Wales. What can we learn from the story of the church in Wales, the history that we've experienced there? How can that inform us as we try to really live into Abolish Poverty and Suffering?
Okay, if I look at it through the lens of Welsh church history, I would say what is happening in the context, 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 context. And so what was happening at the time in South Wales was a social movement and a desire for change. The churches or the chapels were trying to do it. The political sort of Chartist dissenters were doing that, but there was a link missing. Mm-hmm. When I look at today's culture and look at abolished poverty and suffering, I find it abhorrent that as the fifth or sixth richest country in the world, we have so many food banks. You know, I was reading a report that there are more food banks in the UK than there are McDonald's restaurants. That's absolutely abhorrent. You know, and the rich again richer and the poorer are getting poorer. Yeah, I look at my own upbringing as being a son of a coal miner. And yes, life was hard. And yes, there were strikes at times when there was no food on the table. You know, the community gathered around. It probably isn't as bad as that, but there's definitely an inequality and access to education, rights, and opportunities for women. So whilst we live in a free society and access, and for marginalized people, whether ethnicity, and sort of sexuality. I think Wales has got all the right ingredients. It's got the right ingredients for change. It's got the right ingredients in our history. And I think in the sense of Community of Christ, I think we have a wonderful message. So it's aligning those dots as Dan Jones did. He spoke the language. So he was Welsh in the sense, mostly well-spoken now. But if you can speak the language to people, then I think the idea of abolish poverty and suffering is one of the ways that the restoration message can be re-envisioned, and you know, the hell on earth can become Zion on earth.
So you've shared a little bit about some connecting points from the church in Wales. My favorite going forward from this interview is going to be the history of dissent. I'm thinking that would make a wonderful Project Zion podcast and interview major dissenting contributions to the life of the organization. But how do you see other aspects of the church in Wales? Has it had an impact on our kind of institutional personality or our global expression? I mean, other than the fact that the immigration to the United States was hugely impacted by the Welsh Church. But as we look at the church now, do you see a connection to the church in Wales?
Before I answer that question, I think just of interest, sort of Wales is very strong in our culture. It's a singing, it's a dancing, it's a poetic culture. And it's very rich. And a part of that is kind of built and reinforced by local concerts, local competitions called Eisteddfods, Eisteddfodau is the plural word for it. I have 100% certain that the start of the Tabernacle Choir or the Mormon Tabernacle Choir came from the Welsh immigrants. This sense of choral singing and close harmonies. And so I think for me, part of the Welshness is our culture and the expression of the arts. So, you know, in a more digression way, you know, there are some very significant, I think, in my eyes, some actors that take on the characteristics of Welshness. They are strong characters. So people like Newell, Richard Burton, Anthony Hopkins, Catherine Zeta-Jones, they are able to portray the character in ways that other people can't. And I think that becomes from the kind of rehearsals in these Eisteddfods. And so there's a confidence within us. So coming back to the big picture of the church, I think we really need to embrace the diversity across the spectrum of our global church. And what has Wales got to bring into that? I think is a recognition of the role of the arts, how that, you know, the role of poetry, not that I'm a lover so much of poetry, but of art, of music, of drama, of living a way of life, hospitality and acceptance, you know. And not everybody is this way, but I'm a very tactile person, very touchy-feely. We will speak up. We voice our concerns. We dissenters. You know, where things aren't right, we will dissent. And I think as a church, we can learn to have a stronger voice or to stand up with those that have no voice. And that's how I think we can learn from each other. You know, I'm almost sure that a part of the faithful disagreement has its roots in people like Andrew Bolton and myself and Jim Poirier around the World Church Teaching Council, loyal opposition from the Commonwealth that says, hang a minute, I got a position, I have a voice, have you thought of? So I think that idea of faithful disagreement, that there is it's okay to dissent, you know, mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the people that dissent us we need to listen to. You know, it's the voice that they have. I'm trying to think what other aspects. Most people like to talk and we like to listen. You know, and that's a gift too, is to listen to people's story. So I think we have time for people. We like to engage in relationships that are very meaningful and invest time in those relationships. And once those relationships are formed, they're deep, lifelong relationships.
So many questions are going through my mind. One of them being, when we began our conversation, you talked about the fact that Wales is Celtic. You come from a Celtic tradition. And when you talk about the arts, poetry, music, dancing, all of those are inherent in Celtic traditions as well. Do you see any connection in the church, not just in Wales, but in areas that have more Celtic influence, in the Celtic religious tradition of nature, spiritualism, the different aspects that Christianity borrowed and now more fundamental Christians kind of rebel against? Do you see expressions of that in the church in Wales?
Yes, yeah, so there's definitely a kind of willingness to embrace Celtic Christianity. So when I look at sort of way back in sort of my understanding of Celtic Christianity as the first Christians came to these lands, they borrowed the imagery of religious expressions by the Celts, you know, and they borrowed the image of the circle and put it in the Celtic cross, mm-hmm. you know. So all of creation is sacred. All of creation is an expression of the divine. And so that's something when you are sort of Celtic, you just take that for granted, you know, that all of nature, I'm sure you know, Karen, I just love being by the ocean. I just love being in the mountains. I love being around creation. You know, the ocean resets my balance. You have to give, you have to yield your own rhythm to the tide. You have to yield to the waves. So whether it's stormy or whether it's calm, and it's a recentering. So I find myself in very sacred spaces when I'm in creation. So in that way, I can see looking back to some of the sacred religious expressions of how people connected with the divine can help. Because mm-hmm. People are looking at ancient ways of finding new ways. And that can be a way for people to connect.
Yeah. Thank you. That wasn't part of our conversation earlier, but it came to mind as you were sharing. And certainly with our own enduring principle of sacredness of creation, we can see those connecting points in community of Christ. So before we close, I want to shift gears just a little bit. I want to ask you a couple questions. So first, with everything you've told us about Wales and Welsh people, what about you growing up as a community, RLDS/Community of Christ person in Wales? How has the church in Wales influenced you and your discipleship?
So for me, I would say that I am a disciple of Jesus Christ. And I would say the peaceful one. And I choose to live out my discipleship in Community of Christ. So foremost, I follow Jesus, and I find the best expression of that and the best expression of me is in Community of Christ. So I grew up in a place where, in Pentlegair, where my father was a coal miner, and he found a church deep within the coal mine. He was a lay minister that had gone around different non-conformist churches. And there was somebody in this coal mine, a church member. And my dad was offering blessing upon his lunch. We were being probably jam sandwiches or very little. And the conversation started around a meal and took sort of 2 years for him to find that this was something that he sensed a call to. So my mother and father and my three oldest siblings were baptized probably 5-6 years before I was born. So I was born into the Community of Christ. So I find myself born into a community that is extremely loving and supporting. It's a time when the church is growing, it's vibrant, there's lots of activities going on every day of the week, you know, and catering for different voices. And equality is right on the table. You know, talk about women in leadership, women are there, you know, and it is, it's very dynamic. It's very affirming. I grew up in this where at 8 years old, I was baptized. I can't remember a thing about my baptism. It was my birthday. I remember having a football or soccer ball for my birthday, but I do know I wanted to follow Jesus. And that was my decision. I grew up in a place where spirituality was lived. People laughed, they prayed together, they cried together, they kind of shared their heart and their hopes. It was a true sense of community. And probably one of my earliest memories is being in prayer meetings and falling asleep on my mother's knee, but having this sense of you just bathed in love, you know, and acceptance. So I was very privileged to have this sign of community. I think that probably when I was about 10, 11 years old, going to one of our church youth camps and meeting other young people around the British Isles or UK, that we're a part of this church too, and had a similar upbringing, that the God that I experienced in Pentelagae could be experienced somewhere else. And that was really a significant opening for me as a 10, 11-year-old. And a similar experience when I went to European youth camps. We used to have European youth camps every 4 years, and finding in Germany or in Netherlands, finding people, young people like me, didn't speak the same language, but had the same sort of understanding of a God. So I was really, really blessed to be in this. I find myself at 18 years old being elected as being a pastor, a co-pastor in this congregation at 18 years, at 20 years old. And at that age, you're fearless. You think you can do anything. Professionally, I was in a bank. Things were going well. And I think this is what a loving community does. It supports you. It catches you. It encourages you. You're going to make mistakes, but there's lots of grace around, and that can help. But there's a willingness to embrace the giftedness that I brought. I was a district president and leader of an area when I was 22 years old, and I was a 70 when I was 25. But again, in some ways, my professional career was opening up as a banker, but also the church recognized that giftedness and was willing to embrace it. And that meant a lot to me. So I've been fortunate to be brought up in community that values you as an individual, that realizes that you have something to bring. Every has something to bring to the table, and we better because of it. I think a big shift for me in my relationship with God came when the bank needed to relocate me from God's country to that strange land called England. As a corporate banker, they move you around from location to location. Mm-hmm. And beginning of the 90s, there was a recession hitting the south coast of England, and they wanted managers to help that situation. And I found myself, our family found ourselves in a position where we were in church every day of the week. And it was good, but life was so busy. There was something going on, and life was wrapped around church and God, and life was squeezed in the middle of all that. Mm-hmm. And we find ourselves relocated to this strange land called England. And it was only every 2 weeks that the small house group met. And that was a big adjustment for us. And at first we felt guilty. We were not doing, you know, we were not up front or participating or visiting, or, and it was a guilty feeling. And then we found that the rhythm was healthy. It was healthy for physically for ourselves, but also the relationships. And it helped us to separate our relationship between with God and an institution like a church, or expression of community. And what we found that our relationship with God was more honest, more authentic, because we experienced the God in a different rhythm. And it wasn't about busyness or doing. It was about being. And that's a big shift for us. And then identifying and finding community of Christ has a wonderful sense of community and message that helps us be better people, helps us change our world, you know, helps, recognizes our giftedness and wants to embrace that. And so that was a significant turning point in our kind of connectedness with community of Christ, and positively saying, this is the place where for now we want to live out our community, our expression. You know, and we used to have people just over for dinner. You know, even if we had a young daughter at the time, Sarah, she's now 30 years old. But we had an evangelist come once a week, and he used to feed her. And that was his joy of his life. But we were blessed so much by that. And just simple things like we could do hospitality. We could invite people into our home. We could go to places together with friends, or, and friends in the church and outside the church. And I think sometimes our busyness can be a distraction. To be authentic. So as I say, I like to say, I'm a disciple of Jesus, the peaceful one. and I live out my discipleship in community of Christ. Because for me, the values, our identity aligns very much with who I am as a person. And I think I'm a better person by being in community and in community of Christ.
Thank you for sharing that, Richard. In this day and age where busyness has been interrupted by a pandemic, many of us are discovering that new rhythm that we didn't have before and experiencing similar epiphanies, if you will, as we're going forward. One last question about your own self going forward. When you were doing the research for your lecture, or even when you were doing the research in seminary originally for the history of the church in Wales, is there anything that you learned or relearned or explored that has impacted you from your research going forward?
Yeah, I think that the thing that resonates deeply with me, one is that the restoration message resonated with the working class people. And it is context, context, context. Mm-hmm. So you can have the most wonderful message you like, but unless it's relevant and it can be interpreted in the context of people to hear it in their own language or their own context, nothing will happen. So I take away from this the gift of our roots is alongside the people that have been oppressed, the people that want a better life but need some help in getting there, or ideas how to get there. And so the idea of Zion at that time was a reality that says, what I'm looking for, I can have that here. And I think as we look at the sense of building sacred community, we can have that here. You know, and that can be online or it can be in person somewhere. And I think that was the kind of opener of me identifying the core part of where our message resonates with people. And then as I look through the lens of being a Welsh person, how do I use my culture and my giftedness to foster that even more? So
Richard, I want to thank you for being our guest today here on Project Zion podcast and sharing with us so eloquently, not just about the history of the church in Wales, but about discipleship and mission. But before we go, I need to ask you if you have any last comments or closing thoughts that you'd like to offer before we sign off.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity just to share my story. Mm-hmm. I think it's important we listen to our stories, and everybody has a story to tell. When I was preparing this back in April, I deliberately went to the area, this Cauldron area. And whilst there's no expression of the church there, I said, the rocks almost shouted out, this is why, this is our story. Listen to our story. And so whilst there's scars now on that rock, where the coal has been hewed out or the limestone, you know, I look at people's lives and there are scars on people's lives, but they have a powerful story to share, you know, and I've just captured one or two individuals here, but it's in the art of the storytelling that we hear the heart. And I think that's what we just need to listen to, that heartbeat. So let us make time for each other and to listen to the stories that we have to share.
Well, thank you for making time for us today, Richard. And for our listeners, we encourage you to view Richard's lecture, part of the fall lecture series, Church Without Boundaries. You can find it on historicsitesfoundation.org. It will be archived there for you to watch it, as well as many other lectures. What date did it air, or does it air, Richard? Do you know?
28th of October.
Okay, so if you want to watch it live, you'll have to go on the historicsitesfoundation.org website and get that information. And you can participate live, I believe, by chat. You can ask questions as well at the end of the lecture. Or you can reach Richard via email if you have questions about the church in Wales or about the church in Europe currently. And you can find his contact information on the Community of Christ website at seaofchrist.org. You can just put his name in the search bar. I tried it to make sure you popped up, and there you were. So in the meantime, this has been Cup of Joe, part of the Project Zion podcast. I'm Karen Peter with Richard James. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.